Lieutenant General David Barno, U.S. Army retired, senior fellow and co-director of the Responsible Defense Program at the Center for a New American Security. And General Barno was the first commander of military operations Afghanistan, writing in War on the Rocks under the title The Shadow Wars of the 21st Century. And you start this piece out, General, in a very straightforward way. You write, war is morphing. How is war morphing in your view, and how has it changed even in the decade or a little more since you were assigned to Afghanistan, sir?
Well, I think it was interesting for me to watch, even during my own time in the military, which started in the mid-1970s, how war is so dramatically different today than it was back then. That was the era, of course, of the Cold War, where we were worried about the Russians and Soviet armored divisions coming across the border into West Germany at the time. We were worried about legions of Soviet aircraft flying through the skies and submarines under the ocean and even, you know, intercontinental ballistic missiles. Today, warfare doesn't look anything like that. And as we see even our experience in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last decade, and then today as we see the conflict in Gaza, you know, we watch what's happening in Iraq with the, you know, some of the Iraqi insurgents now that are about to overtake potentially the government in Baghdad. And we see what's happening in the Ukraine. We don't see those legions of tanks coming across the border as the threat anymore. And so war is becoming considerably different than what we were all used to and what we used to call conventional war back in the 1970s and 80s and the end of the last century.
The challenge then becomes to build a strategy and a policy about executing that kind of war. You lay out in this piece the challenges of doing so in the context of three scenes of conflict today: Gaza, Iraq, and Ukraine. Each of them, as you lay them out, is different. And so it brings me to the question, at what point does irregular become regular and the rules as we have followed them for the past however many years no longer apply and we need new rules as the basis of how we go about fighting conflict?
Well, I do think that's exactly one of the principal challenges here, that as we look back to the international institutions we built, particularly in the last century, to deal with, you know, the World War IIs and the conventional superpower conflicts that we were all worried about, they were built upon, you know, preventing those large-scale invasions of neighboring countries. In some ways, the last time we've seen anything like that was the right at the beginning of August 1990 when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. That was a conventional armored invasion of a country. It triggered the United Nations resolutions because they were built for just that kind of contingency. NATO was built around the Article 5 provisions in its charter that allowed you to respond to that kind of overt aggression with tanks coming across the border. We don't see that happening anymore. And so our laws, our rules, our international institutions that were built to deal with the aggression of the 20th century may be outmoded to deal with the kind of aggression we see today.
And you write, conflicts of this sort may soon become the most common type of warfare in the future. Is that simply because they appear to be effective, as we're seeing in each of the three theaters of operation that you write about? Or is there a deeper reason, do you think, General?
I think it's two things. I think they're very effective in part because the sponsors of those conflicts oftentimes can prosecute their goals without putting fingerprints on the fight. It's very clear the Russians are behind the subversion in the Ukraine. It's very clear they were responsible for Crimea now, you know, falling out of the orbit of Ukraine and falling under Russia's direct orbit, but they don't have direct fingerprints. There's no Russian tank sitting on streets in Crimea or in eastern Ukraine. So they were able to accomplish all that without having directly being involved. So this idea they're using, you know, indirect means, they're using subversion, they're using surrogates to act for them, I think that's going to be very, very popular. The other thing that I think is also true is that conventional warfare, the large tank-on-tank battles, trigger those kind of international institutions, and they know there's going to be a response. There's going to be a legal framework for the U.S. and many other countries to respond to that. That's not the case when you can't find the fingerprints, and that's where we are in many of these conflicts today.
Yeah, there's a wrinkle here, too, and you call it a conundrum of 21st century warfare, where irregular warriors may be fighting against both friends and enemies of the United States at the same time. And you cite ISIL or ISIS fighting in Iraq against the government supported by the United States, but at the same time fighting against Bashar al-Assad in Syria. What challenge does that present strategy-wise and policy-wise from the United States' position, do you think?
Well, it leads in some ways to some really unpalatable, difficult choices. You know, for our State Department in particular, trying to craft a rationale that suggests we ought to support insurgent groups that are trying to overthrow Assad in Syria, when some of those are incredibly anti-Western, some of them are al-Qaeda affiliates, many of them despise the United States even more than they despise Assad. And then we see, you know, right across the border, those same groups, you know, undermining a regime that we've supported for the last number of years in Iraq. This creates some incredibly difficult choices. And I don't think that issue is going to go away. I think we're going to have to think very hard about this and maybe step back a bit and be less inclined to directly support some of these actors when we can see that, you know, even on today's fight, they may be friendly towards the United States, but tomorrow they could very easily become our adversaries. That's a very common phenomenon I think we're going to see in this century.
Dave Barno of the Center for a New American Security, writing on War on the Rocks under the title The Shadow Wars of the 21st Century. And the response then to these challenges, to the morphing of war, as you write about it, Dave, you write, many of these attributes of warfare in this century are presenting wholly new challenges that may be deeply underappreciated by U.S. strategists who contemplate future wars. The U.S. military may be too deeply invested in very expensive capabilities poorly designed to deal effectively with these new threats. With all due respect, that sounds like it was written by someone who has firsthand experience in a country halfway around the world, sir.
Well, we certainly, during my time in Afghanistan, you know, 10 years ago, were trying to take a square peg of U.S. military built for conventional operations and jam it into a round hole called counterinsurgency and irregular warfare in Afghanistan. And I think that we still very much have a military that's a square peg. And that's, a lot of that is the legacy of what we've built and bought and what we thought militaries did for the last 20 or 30 years of the last century. And the fact that we, as we look at how we spend our defense dollars, we're spending vast amounts of, you know, our $500+ billion defense budget on buying very large, very expensive weapon systems, the systems I'd call designed for the wars of iron, tanks versus tanks, ships versus ships, airplanes versus airplanes. These irregular wars may not fit that model. They may not allow us to actually get the best use out of those investments, and may cause us to have to rethink where we're putting our money and perhaps invest more in special operations forces, more in our intelligence operatives around the world, and more in indirect means as opposed to simply, you know, putting more and more money into bigger and bigger platforms that might not actually be terribly useful in some of these fights.
As I read your piece, General, I was reminded of a book that was on my summer reading list this summer. It's called American Spring by Walt Borneman, and it's a terrific book. I commend it to anybody interested in the American Revolution time period, because Walt went back and looked at firsthand accounts, diaries and letters and so on. And I recall a letter that a British general officer stationed in Boston in the 1770s wrote back to London, in which he said, "These savages don't fight like gentlemen. They hide behind rocks, they hide behind buildings, and they attack us as we walk. They won't stand and fight us." Are we in a similar situation today, General, where we're maybe not lamenting the fact that the opponent won't fight us on our terms, but still not quite understanding how to fight them on their terms?
Well, as the saying goes, history may not repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes. And I think in this case, we're definitely hearing a rhyme from the British general fighting those unconventional Americans during the Revolutionary War. We're seeing very much the same thing. And we didn't fight the British, you know, man-to-man, wearing red coats, you know, faced off at 100 yards, because they were the dominant force in that kind of warfare. The same reason why, you know, our adversaries in this century are not going to fight us tank on tank, airplane on airplane. We dominate and we own that space. We can fight and just destroy any military in the world in a force-on-force fight using our heavy weaponry that are more advanced than any other nation right now. But there, no one is going to want to fight us that way. That's one of the clear lessons for our adversaries looking back over the last 20 years or so. Only a fool would fight Americans in the way they prefer. Better to fight them in ways that they're very uncomfortable dealing with. And we've seen that, I think, in Iraq and Afghanistan both.
And so as we see the proliferation in our arsenal of very high-tech weapons and very sophisticated weaponry, and even in the items that the men and women carry on themselves on a daily basis, we also see the prevalence of low-tech weapons, especially that non-state actors are using. We're all very familiar with the IED problem in Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth. Can we expect to continue to need to think low-tech and maybe think lower and lower-tech as time goes on, General?
I think we're going to, you know, my comment shouldn't be suggesting to our audience that we ought to move away from buying sophisticated weaponry and capabilities. We still need to have the best equipped soldiers and Marines and airmen in the world out there, because they're going to have to use all of those edges that our technology gives them to better their adversaries out there. And that's going to be expensive. We might need to think about exactly what kind of platforms we buy and build, but I think we can't afford to have anything but the very best equipped and best trained soldiers and Marines and sailors out there on the front line. That's crucial no matter what kind of future we're going to face out there. But I do think our adversaries are going to continue to leverage low technology to get at us in ways that were completely unexpected. No one saw the roadside bomb or the improvised explosive device threat as being a major challenge in 2001 or 2003. And by the middle of the last decade, it was dominating headlines. It was causing most of our casualties and was something we were very unprepared for. We're going to continue to see our adversaries out there be very innovative. And because since they don't have billions to spend, they'll spend thousands on small capabilities that are going to get inside of our armor and be able to give us some real challenges we might not have thought about. So thinking about war is going to continue to be very, very important.
You make it very clear in this piece that you are not suggesting that we should go low-tech only or abandon. You write, our long-held commitment to fielding highly capable aircraft and ships or ultra-sophisticated tanks and helicopters. What I wonder, though, is your sense of your colleagues, your former colleagues in the General Officer Corps, about the willingness to accept weaponry that may not be the absolute very last word in state-of-the-art capability, but yet still very capable and much more capable than anybody else has of putting iron on target.
No, I think that's one of the big challenges in acquisition of military weaponry is that we tend to go for the 100% solution, and we pay an incredible amount to get that last 10%, whereas the 90% solution on the battlefield that's out there quicker, that costs less, that allows us to have it when we need it, is a much better answer. You know, we have many programs that take 20, 30, 40 years to actually roll out entirely and be deployed into the force. We're in a world where we're changing our smartphones every 2 years. We're throwing out our computers every 18 months. We probably need to rethink a bit how we're acquiring these high-tech weapons and make sure that we can get that 85 or 90% solution out there quicker and turn it around and improve it when we need to deal with what's the enemy's adapting to out there in the battlefield.
What does that look like from the battlefield commander's perspective, the role in which you served? How does that acquisition process inside the Pentagon need to change to serve that commander better?
Well, I think one of the things that needs to happen is we need to leverage commercial technology more and be more willing to take things like iPhones onto the battlefield and not have invent a military iPhone that takes 15 years to build and deploy out there, and leverage some of the things that in software in particular where we see advances in the commercial sector that are far ahead of where the military is. I think the other thing we need to be able to do is have a rapid acquisition process for when we get into a conflict that we can move and change and shift systems and get capabilities out into the field far more rapidly than we do with the conventional acquisition system. We built some of those rapid equipping programs during the last 10 years of war. They've been very successful. They're now competing with the so-called long-term programs of record that take 10, 20, 30 years to get things out into soldiers' hands. So I think we probably want to relook what we need to get out when and make sure we keep that capability to move things rapidly when we need to.
A decade, 15, 20 years from now, General, we look back at this, at what you're proposing and the ideas that you're advancing. How do we look at that in a future time period and decide we were successful in addressing these challenges and we are able to compete effectively and continue to be victorious in an irregular environment as well as a regular environment?
Well, probably counterintuitively, I think I would argue the most important thing is to recognize that war is a thinking person's conflict. You've got to be smart, you've got to be innovative, you've got to be creative to dominate the battlefield out there and to think about where war is going, what the ends of war are, and how to get to those ends. We've had adversaries that I think have been very creative. I think that's got to be part of the kind of leadership we have inside of our military. We're now at a point where we could lose some of our very talented, very creative young leaders in the coming years as they come back home from these wars and find themselves in a very tight budget environment without money to train, without opportunities to get overseas with their troops and do things that are active and exciting. We've got to do everything we can to keep that intellectual talent, those smart, young, creative leaders in the force, because they're going to lead this force 20 years from now. And we need smart, creative thinkers at the top of the military in that decade to deal with some of these very complicated challenges. That's even more important than having the best tank out there in a lot of ways.